already fired from Sure. and come back with it.
Okay. All right, let's continue. I'm sure some people will have left by now. They will most probably have left by now.
Ah! Johnny! You can get more into seats, so I can't get outvoted yet.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start. Let's look.
Thank you, Chair.
We did agriculture.
We finished agriculture. And we're moving on to human health now. In essence, I mean, there's a whole bunch of work that has to be done. The first one is an interesting one around listen to presentation mode. Is around the impact of air quality. And as the nice thing about any mitigation work that we do and reducing fossil fuel combustion has a dramatic impact on air quality. So using the Air Quality Act, we will also look at improving air as well. There's a whole bunch of work around national policies around building up the resilience of the nation, which is much the same as government priorities around improving our health, the overall health of the nation, improving nutrition, better water supply, and so on and so forth. One of the interesting aspects that comes through from the Department of Health is this design and implement the Heat Health Action Plan, which is specifically looking at an area which we've never really dealt with before, which is the whole aspect of heat strokes and so on and so forth. So this is a completely new approach that the Department of Health is coming up with. This emergency medical services, climate-sensitive disease surveillance and control, safe water and improved sanitation. Other aspects of this as well is something that will appeal to you, Chair, as well as develop a health data capture system. In many instances, although we're collecting relatively good health data, and as you say, a lot of this stuff has already been collected. In terms of looking at the impacts on health from climate change, there's a lot of work that has to be done. And certainly, I mean, a lot of the data is there, but it's not being analyzed in a way that actually makes good information for a climate change response. The other aspect, of course, that the Department of Health has to look at is malaria control and cholera as well, which, of course, are affected by climate change, as we heard yesterday. And one of the things I've also put forward from the Department of Health is to improve the biosafety of the current malaria control strategy. And that, to a large extent, is talking about the use of persistent organic pollutants for malaria control. And starting to use other less harmful substances for malaria control. Then we're moving on to the larger sector, of course.
Okay, let's see health. Any issues?
Just in that last work, actually, what are the other things that they're using?
Well, we're using DET. We had, the Department of Health had some experiments 3-4 years ago using pyrethroids, which of course are natural pesticides, and there was a spike in malaria. And what was happening is that mosquitoes are obviously building up some sort of resilience. And perhaps it was the actual regime, what have you, but there's far more work that is required. And because something there is the biggest killer in Africa, what have you, we basically at this stage don't have real alternatives to DDT. Which of course is scary. I mean, DDT is a controlled substance.
Yeah.
Are you focusing more on the regions? Because you've got regions that are very much malaria, areas in South Africa, and those that are always also affected by cholera, so that there is a focus more on those areas than the generality, for instance.
You know, when I listened to those scientists yesterday, what struck me was that we're going to, and maybe it doesn't fit here, but health is one area that strikes me as being possibly where it'll be needed, is we're really going to need a capacity in government, whether it falls under that data and that evaluation, but a capacity. See, if things are changing where you're suddenly getting more rain, where you're suddenly getting more this, and what it does, it changes patterns of growth of plants, of mosquitoes. Mm. You may, if it's business as usual, you may just go and throw down whatever pesticide you have to kill. But actually, the thing that's now coming up in the east, the west of the country, because And it seems to me we're going to have to find a, and maybe it's when we discuss those kind of institutional capacities we have, to have a capacity where we can see whether we know whether patterns are changing, but whether it's impacting on animals, plants, insects and so on, where it creates those things. Because, you know, otherwise what you're doing is you're not having the capacity to respond to climate change in the sense that it's business as usual. And if you leave it, I mean, I suppose each department, for example, specifically health, I'm thinking, would maybe be able to do itself. But it seems that kind of institutional capacity to be able to analyze, to say over, you know, anything you do, I live here, I see my weather, I see my things. You live there, you see that. Other one lives somewhere else. Government is in the whole country, so it starts analyzing and seeing the bigger picture. But it's those kind of shifts, it seems to me, that we're going to have to create a capacity in government across kind of departmental lines where we can actually start seeing where climate change actually physically starts changing certain things, whether it's animals, etc., etc., so that you can start getting responses to it and not wait for the big disaster and then say, oh, well, you know, we should have actually seen this coming, that there's going to be a huge outbreak of malaria in a place where we never had it before because, you know, the weather patterns are. But I mean, keep that idea more under, I think, institutional capacity, although it affects particular sectors. Ms. Ndude?
I think that's a debate that politicians really need to embark on. Because you look, I think it was, which department was it? This water for, you know, was it environment? Where we realized when we got the list of the staff, myself and then Honorable, you know, Kellyanne, who were looking at the, you know, the qualifications of the staff, and we realized as to why you have got serious problems, that people are not employed in the right places where they specialize, you know, on. And I think really, it can be seen as an attack when people are talking about cadre deployment, but really civil servants, you know, most of them are people maybe that have applied, you know, for position they are employed. There are really some areas where you really need specialists in those fields for you to be able to deliver in what is expected in terms of government. And I'm saying that, Chair, maybe not necessarily with them, but it's a political debate that we need to start looking at collectively as a committee, and something that as parliamentarians in general, we actually start to look at the capacity of the personnel in some of the departments, because that's what hinges delivery. Government and the executive will be committed to deliver this to people, but when it comes to management now in terms of the execution, you find where the stagnation is taking place because of the lack of expertise and the skills and the understanding, you know, of that, and people are just sitting there to occupy those. Those are some of the things that we have observed, you know, within, you know, this department. If you can, you yourself, Chena, you can actually ask to say top management, you want to see, you know, the what is the their level and whether they are the right people in the position that they are in, and look at the CVs and all those things, you'll find that many people are actually misplaced. They are not in the areas where they are supposed to be, and hence you've got this problem. But I'm just saying, I'm mentioning to say it's a debate for another time that we need, and maybe to start talking to the minister to say these are some of the observations that we have observed in this, because this is a very, very critical, you know, area that we are talking about, you know, Chair. You can't just, you know, take a lawyer who's not a scientist to think that is going to be specializing on this. It needs people who are going to be able to understand, or people who, when you get into a position, you actually start beginning to educate yourself so that you can always, you know, be able to understand what is required or, you know, of you. These are some of the challenges that, you know, we are faced with, and that we need collectively to see them as a problem in terms of government, not necessarily that is an issue that the opposition is throwing at government and people just stand up there and defend it. Something that really, really doesn't need, you know, to be defended, but something that needs a collective view and corrective measure, you know, to it. Thank you.
That's fine, but I think, you know, you must, I think a much deeper analysis is needed of it. If you actually sit in government, you'll actually see that part of the problem is the way civil servants is structured.
Mm.
You know, you'll find that simply this. There's only a finite amount of positions. If you are have some ambition, then sometimes what happens, well not sometimes, it happens a lot. You know, in some of the departments are prime example, police being one example. You know, you're in the police, you do what X job you do, and you're a specialist in that area. Of course, when they advertise posts, they advertise it in the police. So suddenly you see you are a detective. Then you see you're going to get a higher post if you become whatever in the police. And you apply for it. Because, you know, you're in the police, you are in the front line to get those jobs. And you'll find that a lot of the problems that exist with placements and so on of people, it's because they're trying to get better salaries. And there's no flexibility in the civil service for the minister to say, you know, this is the establishment. Now you see in climate change you need more people and so on. You have to go through a huge process to get people employed and so on. Now if Luke is sitting there and he sees a ceiling because Joanne Jawitz is above him and he's not going to move, she's like 30 years old, 35 years old, and he sees that for the next 15, 20 years. And what happens then when a job comes in that department in whatever other position, then they apply for it. And, you know, I think, so that's why I say it's a much deeper debate needed, because you actually have to go and look in the civil servants what triggers some of these reasons why people. And if you go and look in each department, I found it in the police where I had some good knowledge when I did that review. I was stunned. I was stunned about how many of your top detectives, they reach a ceiling. And then they become ordinary policemen somewhere else where their detective services are not used anymore. It's ridiculous. So your whole pool of senior detectives are eroding all the time because there's a ceiling. That is why we try to introduce an OSD. Occupational specific dispensation, because then you can keep on people and giving them higher salaries, not tied into those notches and so on. So I'm just saying, you know, this issue about where people are placed and their things and so on, you know, by that I'm not trying to say that, of course there are always people that are for the wrong reasons placed in certain areas and don't have necessarily have the qualification. I have no problem with those kind of debates, but I think there are deeper structural problems in our civil service that just creates huge problems for us in terms of losing people that in certain areas. Employing people at higher salaries just because they know they can't move if they're in a certain place. And if we have to be honest with ourselves, some of the minority groupings would find difficulties and at a certain stage say, okay, well, you know, I the only way I'm going to move up here is to leave or to take another job. So I think there are some very tricky debates around placements and so on, and I endorse your position of saying we actually should start debating this thing and not just see it as a cater deployment issue. There are more structural problems, not to ignore that there are, you know, I mean in any party, it's in government anyway, employ people that are clearly, that they feel more comfortable with. And so that's not the biggest issue. The bigger issue is to look at all these structural difficulties we have, and in the civil service there are really serious structural problems. But as I say, Ms. Ndude said we must keep that on the burner, and I agree with that. It's something we have to keep looking at and keep debating rationally. Mr. Luki, I think that's it. Next item.
Okay, sir.
You see, again, yeah, I just wanted to say again, yeah, you see, for me, when I read this, as a person outside of environment, I just feel like it's business with usual with some creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the heat health thing is, there's something
mm-hmm.
there
mm-hmm.
that we're going to do. But I just feel that, and I'm not one of those people who want to tie us down to all kind of targets, because I know that they don't work nicely, and you always get difficulties with them, and people chase targets instead of doing the right thing and so on. But I do think that, I just feel under each sector we need to be a bit more, must be a bit more oomph, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Adaptation strategies, these are adaptation things that we have to start looking at. And you know, I just feel we're not, maybe I'm not, just not, when I go and read the whole document properly and in context, I may get the feeling, I mean, you're pulling out certain things, but I must say, I'm going to keep coming back to this. I just feel, this is like kissing your sister, you know. You have to do it from time to time for on birthdays and congratulate her and so on. But there's no real intent in it. Okay.
So no, absolutely. I think, you know, in the when one goes through this as well, and having had the presentations yesterday from the scientists, you would think that there'd be some more urgency around certain issues as well. And hopefully through this process as well, we can actually start giving that level of oomph. And I think your suggestion of the template is an excellent one. We need to go forward with that. But what the other?
Are you meeting on these things that you go in these road trips? Are you meeting each sector also?
We meet the sectors within the Governmental Committee on Climate Change. We are dealing with, we've got a number of specific focus sessions coming up on financing and the.
Well, you know, I think you must think about that. Is that when you've gone through your processes of consultation and you find some areas that need sharpening up, it may be worthwhile then to have a, even if it's just with you or the department, each department, and just say, look, these are areas we want you to sharpen up. I mean, there's strong push for us to sharpen it so that they do the work and do the thinking.
Absolutely.
And so on. So maybe you must just bear that in mind in your consultations going ahead.
No, definitely. I mean, in terms of the bilaterals, we're going to have bilaterals specifically on the comments that you raised. And that, of course, that's our biggest leverage whenever we have a discussion about the department. The other point that you made is around the whole aspect of climate change indicators and tracking. It's huge sadness, for example, that the COO, Lisa, who was here and attended her apologies, she lost three of her closest family members to cerebral malaria, in an area that is not supposed to have malaria, and that's recently in the last 5 years. She's from Beauty in Limpopo, northern Limpopo province. So it's already happening, and the whole aspect of tracking these and keeping our maps up to date about where the malaria areas is just fundamentally important just to save people's lives. So within that whole thing, in the monitoring section as well, we've got this whole aspect around we have to start looking at climate change indicators and start giving us an indication of what the impacts really are. So looking at changes in rainfall patterns and these sort of situations. Then there was the last question was around the malaria areas, and that's exactly it. I mean, the whole sort of situation of monitoring exactly how disease may be spreading is really, really fundamental. Because you have this sort of situation where suddenly somebody comes out with malaria, goes to the local hospital. The hospital is not used to treating cases like this, and they're basically misdiagnosed.
If you think about it, we don't have those indicators, and we don't have proper evaluation and analysis systems, then we'll always never be able to go beyond the thing of saying there are certain things that are changing in the climate. We can't pinpoint any event to it, but if you start having data that shows that fundamentally things are changing, that you know, your malaria patterns are changing because the rain is falling at different places now, where they didn't before, and if you know those kind of stuff, and floods. If you have those indicators, then you can actually start saying, well, you know, if you look at these figures here, you'll see there's something happening. You know, whether you want to pinpoint it to something, actually the country must gear up for huge outbreaks of malaria or cholera or whatever, you know. I mean, because this is what's starting to happen, and we're not prepared for it now. Okay, let's move on.
All right, so we're now moving into the mitigation sector. Those are the three key adaptation sectors. The first key mitigation sector is energy, for obvious reasons. 78% of our greenhouse gas emissions are from the energy sector, and so that's the generation of electricity from road transport, emissions from mines, or specifically from coal mines, and so on and so forth. So the first thing is that in terms of our energy planning, and our whole move around energy planning, is to include our peak, plateau, and decline trajectory within our energy plan. And for the first time, this current integrated electricity generation, IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan, is now being debated at the moment, has actually started taking greenhouse gas emissions into account, and therefore there's a very large amount of renewables that has never appeared in any energy plan before. The whole aspect of using economic instruments to internalize the cost of carbon through the introduction of a CO2 tax, and that's been the basis of the Treasury discussion document. And as you will, of course, notice that the CO2 tax was increased yesterday.
Yeah.
0.5 cents.
Yeah.
So that's also gone up. The whole aspect of creating a proper business environment for renewable technologies is interesting, and many people don't know this, but 60 years ago, South Africa was a leader in solar water heating. And the reason we were that a leader was that there was a thing that all of our stations had to have hot water. And many of our stations had no access to electricity whatsoever, so they had solar water heaters. And we were one of the largest manufacturers. And then suddenly when we introduced electric trains, all the solar water heaters at our stations were then replaced with electric geysers, and the entire industry collapsed. So 60 years ago, we were the world leaders, and now we're actually, there's more solar water heating done in Denmark than there is in South Africa. So there's a real requirement to build up that capacity again. The whole aspect of ambitious research and development programs around renewables and new, novel, and innovative approaches to the diversification of our energy mix is fundamental. And our current gap-filling research we're doing around the Green Paper, I mentioned this, is that the level of innovation, just looking at our patents around energy, is dire. It's diabolical. Our energy patents and our work around energy research is almost non-existent. And I guess that's because, for instance, we've always had very, very cheap electricity. We have 200 years of coal, so there's no real driver to actually look at any other sources. There's the aspect of we must identify and resolve the financial, regulatory, and institutional barriers that may be impeding renewable energy. And we know that this is the situation. We've got feed-in tariffs, but there's no power purchase agreement signed. And there always seems to be a new barrier that pops up whenever we seem to be going in that particular direction. We have to review and scale up the original target of 10,000 gigawatt hours for renewable energy, even though that target was, we were supposed to have it by 2013, and we've only achieved about 2% of that target already, even though it's been saying for 70 years. So that we need to meet that and of course scale up. There's also talk.
Who's the champion on renewables?
The champion on renewables? The Department of Energy.
No, if it's the department, I'm happy.
No.
I'm just wondering to what extent it's ESCOM.
No, ESCOM is certainly not the champion for renewables.
Funny things happen in government.
Well.
No, I'm happy that it's fine.
No, but sure, but it's an important point because, for instance, at the moment, in terms of the champion for demand side management, ESCOM is regarded as the champion for demand side management. And it's basically the kind of analogy that's been used is that during an electricity crisis, during a food crisis, you ask butchers to advocate vegetarianism. It's just simply not in their interest. Even if, for instance, there is a meat crisis, you really don't ask butchers to advocate vegetarianism because it's just really not in their interest to do so. And that's always been the argument about having ESCOM doing demand side management. In actual fact, ESCOM's job is to generate electricity and sell electricity.
Yeah.
So it's seen for them to actually physically engage in getting people to use less of their products. It just seems to be a bit of a concern. And in actual fact, this is time.
I've said to you that on the demand side stuff, we need to get specific programs, and that must be stated in the paper.
Absolutely.
That particularly ESCOM and SASOC, that from government side we need to drive specific programs that and government has to spend budgets on the fact that they have to create efficiency on the demand side. And there, if you say it particularly that this feeling is very strong that that should be done as a responsibility of government and not institutions linked to government that have an interest in that industry. Because in the end of the day, you know, as you say, je maak je wolf skaap wagter.
Yeah.
For those that do not understand the delicious language of Afrikaans, you do not make the wolf the shepherd of the sheep.
Then, of course, Chair, there's the whole aspect of rolling out a nuclear program as well. And, of course, nuclear is far more, it's far more, that massive reduction of carbon, of course. The renewable energy policy, which is already under review, this whole aspect of innovative structures.
Is there a policy?
There is a.
And you're saying it's under review?
There isn't one in place. It's completely under review, and that they all are actually reviewing the targets and the policy as well. There really has been a dramatic shift in the work around renewable energy. And one could argue that perhaps that one of the internal conflicts within the department was resolved at the last elections, where the Department of Minerals and Energy was split into Mineral Resources and Energy. Because one could say that, for instance, if you have a department that is completely involved in mining and coal is a major resource, then the energy side is going to be driven by that. Having split the two, there seems to have now been an internal potential conflict, I think, seems to have been resolved. The whole aspect around sustainable financing mechanisms.
Hang on to your horses.
This work is already also starting as well. There's an activity called SARI, which is the South African Renewable Initiative, which is starting to look exactly at financing mechanisms and how we can actually do this. Invest in new and clean coal technologies and efficient technologies. This is the whole aspect of we have got 200 years of coal, and there's no intention of keeping it in the ground. But set ambitious and mandatory targets for energy efficiency and other sub-national sectors, and this is the whole aspect of demand-side management. Improve energy efficiency, knowledge and understanding of various sectors through awareness campaigns, demonstrations, audits, education, and so on and so forth. Mandatory labelling for household appliances. This is why the sadness is that, for instance, even it's normally the people that are the most poor that use far more electricity because their appliances are so bad, so inefficient. Legislate requirements for the installation of energy management system in large-scale office buildings. There's a huge potential for savings in our buildings. And replace all demanding energy.
Well, the government departments just switch the lights off at night. I mean, my Department of Justice, when I used to leave at night and I look at this, then the whole thing is lit up like a Christmas tree for the whole night. Those lights burn for the whole night. No one switches it off.
Chair, there was an exercise done at a municipality in Edenvale where they found on their major outreach buildings, they did a full energy audit, and they found that the energy usage after hours was higher than during the day. And they couldn't understand how that could possibly be the case. There was no one in the building. And the reality was that the air conditioning system was obviously set for when people were in the building. When people left the building, the air conditioning system carried on running. So it froze the building, and eventually it hit a set point, which then it started heating the building. It would then hit another set point after it had heated to a certain temperature and would start cooling it again. And overnight, they save 50% of electricity with one audit on a municipal building. Develop and implement and maintain greenhouse gas emissions information. This, of course, is critical. I mean, this is the baseline of our mitigation, is that you have to have a greenhouse gas inventory. It has to be up to date. You must be able to monitor exactly what your emissions look like. Develop an initiative to roll out an energy management training system. The whole aspect, and this has been one of the most important aspects around the electricity crisis, is that people have started, and over the last 2 years, started talking about energy more than they've ever done before. In fact, there was somebody who made a comment, it's a very glib comment, that in terms of dining room table conversation with friends, the issue has moved from crime to how to save electricity. And that in itself has been a very, very interesting move. People who've never even thought about electricity are now talking about how you save electricity and so forth. And of course, what we need to do is capitalize on that and encourage that behavior and inform it even more. Legislation, policy, and regulatory frame to support carbon capture and storage. This is an area where South Africa has potential. And certainly in terms of carbon capture and storage from our coal to oil plants, where the CO2 stream is very, very poor, there's a real potential here. So that was energy.
Okay, Mr. Freyland?
Yeah, no questions there. I mean, it's a bit difficult because I know you're not the lead department on these things, so I can't really take you to talk. But
you're welcome.
Okay, no problem. I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, the one you talked about, the review of the paper on renewable energy. Now, part of our problem is that that review has been done. I think it's been completed in September last year. And in fact, I think it was a precondition of the World Bank loan that such a review gets done, because the World Bank specifically asked what was our policy on renewable energy, and we had to do this. The problem is that now still hasn't come out into the public domain. It still hasn't been released. And I know that it sets quite ambitious targets for renewable energy. And the problem is it doesn't speak to the current IRP that's being drafted. So, I mean, what I would try and push your department to try and do is to say, can we start to see what is in this review of the white paper? Because we need to see what is possible in terms of renewables. And I don't think the IRP, although it puts certain targets for renewable energy, I don't think it's ambitious enough. And I think we need to see what the full possibility is in terms of that review. So that's the one part. I mean, even the SARI that you mentioned, the South African Renewable Initiative, also puts very ambitious targets for renewable energy, far more ambitious than what's contained in the current IRP. So I think we really need to start to interrogate that, because otherwise this is just words done on a document. You know, it can say it commits to that, but we need to make sure that we're getting the full potential of that. And then on the energy efficiency side, which is something I feel very strongly about, I really don't think that we are actually planning for major energy efficiency in this country. If you look at the current IRP, it only models 3,400 megawatts of energy savings by 2030. This is way below what most estimates, in fact, ESCOM's own estimates, are saying we could save about 12,000 megawatts. So that would then obviate the need for building a whole bunch of power stations. I mean, if we get really serious about energy efficiency, and we haven't got serious about it. I mean, all of these words do not mean, they've only got two people running the Energy Efficiency Agency under CEF, and with hardly any budget. So we really need to interrogate, and I would say that your department should start to take the Department of Energy to task about how serious we really are about energy efficiency. And I'm just interested, when we talk about making energy efficiency mandatory, have we actually started on that process yet? Because I know there was a voluntary accord signed with companies, particularly the big industrial users, where I think 25 companies use 40% of our electricity. But I don't think they've met a lot of those targets that are in that voluntary accord. And perhaps now is time to start to actually legislate energy efficiency, to actually force a lot of these companies to start to take on such measures. Because, I mean, that is the cheapest, quickest, most environmentally friendly way for us to get out of this energy crisis. And I think we really need to start to unpackage some of these things in here. We can't just let it stand as a kind of statement of fact when clearly we're not giving it enough attention.
Mr. Morgan?
I similarly am conscious of the fact that, you know, it's not the energy department. But let me raise a few issues anyway. One of the things, I've read this twice already, but I'm trying to reread quickly now. One of the things I actually think could specifically be included in the green paper under energy, would it be energy efficiency? It would be energy efficiency. That I think we could do relatively easily is, I mean, government is the biggest procurer of goods in the South African economy, quite frankly. I mean, nothing can compete with government across all spheres of government, all spheres, its ability to actually buy things. And in doing so, to also actually use its buying power to change the market, quite frankly. And I think there's great potential for government actually to itself institute regulations on, for example, standby time for all appliances it buys. Now, it actually would make a significant difference if, for example, every computer, every flat screen TV, I'm sure governed by the lot, you might say in your deputy minister's office, we buy stuff basically, and if fridges, video recorders, DVD players, must be hundreds and hundreds of thousands. And we use so much power, Mr. Leakey, as you know, when things stand by, when they're actually not in use. And I'm aware of this being done in other countries where government, through its procurement, has said, this is the absolute maximum standby time you may procure. And granted, I mean, this is where I guess the PFMA will be a bit of a problem. Granted, in some cases we're going to find, you know, X flat screen TV or whatever costs the one that's more efficient costs a bit more, but it's something we're going to have to factor in because it's going to save electricity. And the reason I say is we can, you know, change the market is, of course, the people importing the stuff, because admittedly a lot of it's imported, are soon going to realize actually that, you know, the biggest buyer in the market is doing it. I actually think it's almost worthy of its own bullet point in the green paper. Then secondly, and which is more explicitly your domain, Saliki, is really, I want to get to grips with the LTMS. Now, it's clear, I mean, the LTMS is 2007, I haven't read it recently, but I mean, I know the graphs, you've got a kind of business as usual graph, and then you've got deviation. Now, I granted you have to have that kind of process, but in some respects, and I mean, and I'm perfectly respectful of the process, I mean, the business as usual graph is in some respects, I know it's based on various indicators, but it's easy to do a deviation if you have quite a significantly steep business as usual graph. And actually, when you guys did that, I'm not convinced. I actually think you factored in a higher economic growth at that point when you did that than there've actually been in subsequent years. Of 2008, 9, 10, and even projections going forward. That's the one point I want to make, is really how accurate is the business as usual graph. And I guess flowing out of that, does the business as usual graph get readjusted now at some point? I mean, is there another process? Because why should we all, and all collectively, including yourself, give credit to deviations in 2025 if actually it wasn't that hard to achieve anyway? And the business as usual graph was overly ambitious all along. That's the first point. Is there a kind of rejuvenation? And the reason I raise it under this section is because a lot of the deviations from business as usual, which are set in the 2020-25, are exactly when, around about the time government plans to have a nuclear fleet, you know, in operation, which is not carbon neutral, but I mean, it's certainly I admit it's less carbon. And so that's why I raise it under this particular section, because, and to add to that is, I mean, what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing? Because you guys did the business as usual, you did LTMS in 2007, and IRP2 is not even really completed, quite frankly. I mean, it came substantially later. And it gives you an idea. I mean, I know the government had a lot of ideas of what it wanted to do, but we surely have to consistently re-look at the LTMS. And is it my first question is it relevant still? Because you guys are doing the communications to the United Nations on this, and actually, is it ambitious enough? Because it's easy to, and once again, I mean, my comment's entirely good faith. It's easy to create a massive business as usual and say, look, we're so wonderful, we've deviated from business as usual, we're amongst the best performing countries in the world and we've done our best. But actually the argument is, could we be more aggressive in our peak plateau decline than we currently are? And I link to my colleague's point, I know Lance is very outspoken on our renewable energies targets not being ambitious enough. I mean, he's correct, of course. If they were more ambitious, we could be putting forward even more ambitious peak plateau decline. And so, in some respects, I don't know what's driving what, because we've got this peak plateau decline. You know, why can't we just have, maybe I sound naive here, why can't we just have more renewable energy? Why can't government just allow more people to get the refit and to have better refits, and bring more people on to the grid, quite frankly, and have a more ambitious reduction going forward. So I guess some of that's comments, and what I really want you to do is kind of lead us on some discussion about the LTMS, which I think is particularly relevant in this section when we're dealing with mitigation. Thank you.
So looking, there's a lot of bows to your arrow.
Thank you, Chair.
Answer to what extent you can.
I will do. Chair, I mean, many of the questions have been raised through the provincial workshops as well, and these have been seen as areas where the Department of Energy has to actually sharpen their pencil and go and look at these sort of things. You're quite correct. I mean, in terms of the SARI, the Strange Acronym, the South African Renewable Initiative, they are modelling that initiative around the 15% renewables by 2020. Which means, and I think this also asks the question about what the biggest barrier is that just to do that 15%, in other words, to provide 15% of electricity from renewable sources, will require an additional, that's above the coal-based tariff, of 50 billion rand. Now, the intention, maybe that doesn't sound like a huge amount of money, what it actually in fact boils down to is a 3% increase in our current electricity tariff overall. The intention, of course, is to try and find a means of actually channeling international funds into actually meeting that gap, and that's the intention. And so, so SARI is looking at relatively impressive targets, and they're looking at the mechanism of exactly how to do that, and to try and provide an elegant means by which the international community can start paying for these things as part of their what they need to pay for. So there's some nice things happening, but within that sort of situation, I can hear the point of saying, well, why aren't they aligned? Why isn't the IRP aligned to the SARI and what have you. And to a large extent, I guess that's why it isn't. I mean, because it's expensive and we can't afford it. And that's the kind of discussion that was done. But I'm not going to defend it. The comments, I believe, are important. They're certainly just echoing a number that we're receiving. The aspect around the EE Accord, that the Energy Efficiency Accord is reviewed by the National Business Initiative. And they basically found that the accord itself, without a proper baseline, it was very difficult to measure really what was happening. And I think this is something that we really struggle with, and I think it comes down to your LTMS situation, mm-hmm. is that we talked about the peak, plateau, and decline trajectory for our greenhouse gas emissions. We have made the international, what we call the Copenhagen Undertaking, which is the 34% and the 42%. Mm-hmm. But without defining what the baseline actually is, we've said 34% and 42% on business as usual, but we never actually published anything called business as usual. So, and a lot of people see this as a clever negotiating ploy, is that we make these what sound like really grand international commitments that are actually not based on substance. That there's no number attached to it. So within that, it's strange that you've asked me the LTMS question, because I've been dealing with that issue over the last 2 days and preparing a presentation for the National Planning Commission on what are the actual numbers. So I've got an entire presentation, and you'll find, first of all, that unfortunately, I wished that the growth without constraints trajectory that we modelled had a whole bunch of fat in it. Mm-hmm. The reality is that we've updated our greenhouse gas inventory initially, and we've got results now to 2010, and we're tracking the growth without constraints. In other words, our actual emissions mm-hmm. are tracking the growth without constraints trajectory. In other words, even if we thought we had fat in us, we haven't. That's exactly how we are doing it. We've also looked at a projection to 2020 as well to see kind of where we will be there. And although there is a movement away from the business as usual, the growth of our constraints trajectory, it is still slightly above the current development path. So in other words, the path that we predicted with our current energy efficiency accords and our current renewable target, we're still slightly above that. So in other words, the LTMS for warts and all was actually in a very, very accurate prediction of the future. And our greenhouse gas inventory is tracking it. Because remember, it was based on an estimate from 1994's greenhouse gas inventory. And with that in mind, I mean, it's been quite remarkable in terms of where it's tracked. Which of course starts making, if that's the way we're going, and even though we've been talking about climate change and there have been a whole bunch of talks about where we need to go and what have you, it's quite clear that we've actually not done anything. We've not built any new renewable power stations and these things. These things haven't actually come on stream yet. Mm-hmm. the only real energy investments that we've made are new coal-fired power stations, which of course are the ones that we have to take into account. So within this sort of situation, you know, we can be as ambitious as we like, I believe, but we have to actually be really, really pragmatic about what is possible. And to a large extent, I mean, I'm hoping that the integrated resource planning for electricity, this ILP2, is already starting to make things, it's kind of make commitments that have never been seen in this country before, kind of levels of commitments that are quite dramatic, to be honest. And we could sort of say, well, that's just not good enough. We want 100% better than that. But we haven't even got the first one yet. So I think, you know, and I'm not going to defend the position, but I think, you know, in all these sort of situations, I think we must be courageous in what we expect to do. But we must also be pragmatic in what is possible. With the point around government as consumer, I think this is just fundamental. And I think we just continuously miss this opportunity, and especially from the environmental sector. If one considers the amount of paper that is generated and used by government, I mean, just simply looking at the government printer and demanding that, for instance, all government gazettes are on paper that has got a sort of at least a 50% recycled, post-consumer recycled content into it, would change the entire face of paper recycling in this country, because we are huge paper users. Yeah. That's the situation. The only place that it seems to be really being looked at this stage is around government procurements of government's fleet. And that there's talk, and it's not in the this discussion about how we'd look at it, but the whole sort of situation of that a certain percentage of the government fleet should be electric vehicles. And this, to a large extent, is to support the indigenization of electric car industry. And that, of course, makes a huge difference. I mean, if one thinks about the government garage, especially in Pretoria, for example, many of those vehicles travel around Pretoria. They never leave Pretoria. So electric vehicles are perfectly suited for that. The other interesting thing about pushing the electric vehicle aspect as well is that one of the biggest problems of renewables is storage. Whereas electric vehicles are mobile storage. You basically have batteries and you can store your renewable energy right there and then. So we all become storage devices. So there's a whole bunch of really interesting initiatives around here where government can actually start using its government as consumer, and especially around energy efficiency. But I think we can take that one step further as well, the whole aspect of carbon footprint. The department has done a carbon footprinting exercise, which has been very, very interesting. And we know we're in a building that we rent. It's a typical South African office block that has a central switch system. So in other words, you can't switch off the lights individually in an office. You can only switch off on a floor. So basically what happens is that your security people then start going floor by floor by floor at 7 o'clock at night. Everybody's out of the building and switched off. But if anybody's working late, then the entire floor stays lit, of course. So there's a whole huge element around this sort of situation as well. The elements about, for instance, flying, for example, and looking at the use of teleconferencing. One of our biggest footprints is around our travel. Mm-hmm. And we're based in Pretoria. Parliament's in Cape Town. Yeah. So whenever we do this, I mean, the entire office flows backwards and forwards. So within that sort of situation, the whole thing about video conferencing, which we have a very good setup within the department, with the ministry here, and it works very, very well. The other aspect, we've lost our major carbon footprint, of course, is our ships, but we've not passed that carbon footprint onto some other department. But within that sort of situation, I think the whole aspect of government carbon footprinting as well, because once again, it's a measure, it's an indicator of exactly what our energy use is. And the department should start internal competitions about who could become the most energy efficient department. Mm-hmm. So not only should it be government as a consumer, it should be government as setting an example too. So with that, then finally, in terms of the LTMS, exactly as I said, we've done an exercise of looking at exactly where LTMS was, whether it was so far off, because as time progresses, more and more people sort of say, well, the LTMS is outdated and it wasn't very good to start off and what have you. The reality was it was an excellent piece of work. And huge amounts of buy-in, and a lot of the people who signed off on it are now criticizing it, but that's also fine. It's, you know, after a period of time, these things happen. But what we've shown with the update of the greenhouse gas inventory is that the accuracy of the predictions are really quite phenomenal, to be honest. Because, of course, at the time of the LTMS, we never predicted the global slowdown, economic slowdown. We certainly didn't predict the massive electricity crisis we had over that period as well. So there are a whole bunch of really quite important things which change our greenhouse gas profile, but what's happened is that we're starting to see exactly where we are.
You said it's tracking. We haven't brought anything new online, barring one or two mothballed stations that have gas turbines. And taking into account the slowdown and the electricity crisis, why are we tracking? Where's the emissions coming from?
From Eskom. Basically, I mean, we're running our power stations at 110% of their normal availability.
Mm.
So it's massive intensity. So our coal usage has gone up dramatically. And it's having not only just impacts on our greenhouse gas inventory and our greenhouse gas emissions, but on the air pollution in general. Because basically with all the power stations under pressure, normally, if, for instance, the pollution control device went down, the power station would be taken offline. These days it isn't. So for the first time in probably about 10, 15 years, you actually start seeing black smoke coming from one of our power stations. We never saw that before. And it's simply because they can't turn the power station off. So the increased emissions are largely as a result of a massive an increase in our energy supply. But also you'll recall that the LTMS only predicted the measurements from 2003. So it left out that entire period where we had the situation where we were putting 50,000 new vehicles on the road a month. And you'll recall that from that stage. And of course every single one of those vehicles was burning petrol. So our transport, our fuel usage in the country has also gone up dramatically. And every time that goes up, then, of course, our emissions go up. The nice thing is that in terms of the models now, is that from now, there is a downward trend from the growth of our constraints trajectory. But as I said, it only ends at what we expect it to end at, as the current development path. We can't sit back and say, well, we're doing a whole bunch of stuff, because it's not being reflected in the actual data.
May link with another section, Chair. But just for your purpose, Mr. Nisaliki, one of the only because I know the guy, and I encouraged him to put in a submission. One of the submissions we are going to have in our thing is from a guy called Terry Vendris. I don't know if you've come across him. He's very low key, but completely nice, genuine guy. And when you're talking about electric vehicles, he basically has invented and perfected a device which retrofits all engines. He's going to be doing it to my car soon, and reduces emissions by on average 35% retrofit. And I managed to help him get into the government fleet in the Western Cape. He's got fitted six. They're doing a project now. It's exceeding all their expectations, with the intention of rolling it out. And has, from what I hear, just secured a massive buyout from the Chinese, basically. And involved with, I'm not punting commercially at all. I'm just saying it's an issue. It shouldn't just be about electric vehicles, of course. Of course, the other thing as well is hydrogen as well. I mean, commonly people would go like, oh well, hydrogen you're driving around is a mini bomb. It's not the case anymore. I mean, I know that a Chinese company now, which are also pretty much in South Africa, formerly you would have to store the hydrogen. Now actually the science of it is when you put down the accelerator, that chemical transaction only happens for the moment the accelerator is down. So there's and creates the hydrogen. There is no hydrogen. Creates the catalyst is there, which drives. There's nothing stored in the vehicle, which is dangerous, of course. And it's all been
this car's name, tick tick, tick tock.
And I'm just one thing. One of the risks, and of course, this is an issue for economic development. Of course, you can invest all you want, and possibly I know growth paths say, well, you know, we're going to choose our winners and losers.
Yeah.
But I personally worry about the electric vehicle because of battery. Batteries are a major problem, and of course they draw on the electricity grid. And you know, electricity comes from coal, so it's not abundant. Actually, you know, the one of the futures in terms of your kind of cars that are just going to be driving around cities and doing low mileage is this new generation of hydrogen cars, which are not mini nuclear bombs driving around.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
And we're going to see a whole bunch of these cars from the Chinese probably very, very, very soon selling at in the region of 100,000 rand a vehicle. And some say, you know, if the government's going to do it, just be very careful about actually. My point is, I actually suspect we missed the electric vehicle. There's a whole new generation of cars which is going to outstrip the electric vehicle going forward. And I realize we've got the Juul, which is a very nice way of keeping former army guys involved in productive activities. But I think we might have missed the bus. So that's my personal opinion.
I think there's a...
Can I just say that I think we're going into a huge amount of detail around these things with a department that's not really involved in it.
Yeah.
And I'm not discouraging it, because I think it's all interesting and we can learn from it. But let's bear in mind there's cricket on the go.
I agree. So I cut the short because just answer for Morgan.
I'm not just saying it to you.
Car name. He said you don't know the car name from China.
What is it?
This is a BYD. This is very famous. This America. This is Buffett involved inside 30% shareholder this company. So this car will be famous in the future. After 10 years, cover all the world. So this car name is a BYD. You must understand.
I think it will get the nickname TikTok.
I worry for Julie. Julie, because it gets the funding from IDC. Now, in the IDC now refuse to give the second this beneficiary for this funding because they scared. From the Julie is funding by the South Africa, but this is not a property. It can development competition with the outside country like the China. He's selling the car. After 2015, they started selling the car. Each car price is about 350,000 rand. Then you say the China coming at 150,000. It's a beautiful, also better to the South Africa design. I don't know, Julie, how can life, how can survive?
I agree. Anyway.
I'm going to put you all in contact with these companies so you can go and be salesmen. Yes, Mr. Freeman.
Contribute to the debate as well, because I think it's hydrogen electric vehicles though, because if you're going to create hydrogen on board, you need a charge, so you still need some electric, so you'll still need battery, you'll still need that summer. But anyway, that's it. One point that was raised, I mean, you did a carbon footprint. I mean, I truly, something which I've been pushing for with Parliament for a long time is to do not just a carbon footprint, but in fact an ecological footprint. And I really think that we should try and push it at this stage ahead of COP17. That we do a proper ecological footprint of Parliament. I mean, the fact that we've still got Parliament's label on a water bottle, which they hand out at meetings, I think is a tragedy. I think the Department of Water would have a, you know, should have a major problem with that. So I think that is one practical thing that we can do as Parliament and that we should do. And then just also on a lighter note, I think that one of the energy efficiency initiatives which Japan introduced actually to major effect. And I would certainly support as the Cool Biz Initiative, which actually said in summer that people are not allowed to wear jackets or ties to work, and it reduced the air conditioning bills and the air conditioning energy usage massively. And again, a conservative country like Japan to do that is something else. But perhaps these are the kinds of things we need to start to think about. If we start to make energy efficiency our national priority, then perhaps, you know, ideas like this will start to get some credence in.
Okay. I don't think you want to respond to any of that, do you? It's all good ideas for you. You can put them all in there.
We need
mechanisms to reduce emissions. We need other sources of energy to be examined and explored in cars. I think if you put those two things there, then we've got everything.
Absolutely. Right, in terms of industry, looking at commerce and manufacturing, there's this compile a climate change response action plan for the commercial manufacturing sector that details short, long-term responses and actions. We'll use Section 29 of the Air Quality Act to manage greenhouse gas emissions from all significant industrial sources. And there's a particular section of the Air Quality Act is the priority pollutants, which means that we declare greenhouse gases as priority pollutants, and then we demand all companies that produce greater than 0.1% of our total emissions for the sector have emission reduction plans coming from those companies. The CO2 tax, of course, will have an implication there as well. At the moment, the current CO2 tax is only applicable to electricity generated from non-renewable resources. But there's a whole aspect of looking at the extension of that tax to all greenhouse gas emissions. Once again, energy efficiency comes through. Accelerated research, development, and implementation of carbon capture and storage once again, and this is, of course, for companies like Sasol. And this has obviously come through about engage vigorously on the multilateral climate change negotiators to ensure a fair and effective outcome that is in accordance with the principles of equity and common fiduciary responsibility. Industry is, of course, very, very concerned about its competitiveness. And so, therefore, you know, where the international negotiations are concerned, they want a sort of situation where our competitiveness will not be undermined by our commitments. That was industry.
Just go on with all the industrial stuff.
Then the next one is mining and mineral resources. Now this one...
Okay, no. Let's do the industry. Anything? Mr. Phelan?
Did you get that from industry itself? I mean, or is that from a government department?
It's from a government department.
From a government.
No. We didn't take anything from industry itself.
No. Because, I mean, that last line sounds like something that industry itself would be saying. But, I mean, is that from the Department of Trade and Industry that essentially
yes.
looking
yes.
there for?
Absolutely.
Okay,
next one.
Mining and mineral resources. Now, this one, you'll see
Dr. Wong?
Chairperson, I think it's for industry, for the climate change. Yesterday, I remember Dr. Peter Johnson, he said, he involved in the municipality, this local government action plan. And for your presentation, the second paragraph for the incorporate, not fully incorporated for the iPad industry, this policy action plan. From your department side, I want to understand why you are not fully incorporated for this action plan. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Answer, Mr. Luki.
Honorable Wong will know that, I mean, if you look at the new industrial action plan, it now does fully incorporate it. At the time of writing, for the last couple of years, in fact, it hasn't. It just simply hasn't done so at all. And it's only in the last revisions of it over the last 8 months that it's now fully incorporated. So the whole thing here is that we have to continue to do that. Climate change must underpin a lot of the work that is in that action plan. And luckily, with this new version, it does exactly that.
Next one.
All right. The next one is mining and mineral resources. And Chair, you'll see that these particular actions are slightly different, in the sense that they're actually smart. There are times and numbers there. And it says by 2015, there'll be compile, initiate, and implementation of a strategy and action plan to reduce fugitive emissions of methane. Methane, for those of you who may have not picked it up, is a very, very powerful greenhouse gas. So the conversion, of course, not only is it a powerful greenhouse gas, but it's also a very, very good fuel. So if you can capture the methane and burn it, you reduce the greenhouse gases and you have fuel. So the idea is to reduce it by 42% from the 2000 baseline by 2025. And so this is looking at the capture of methane emissions from our coal mines. By 2012, compile and initiate the implementation of an action plan for the national rollout of appropriate coal bed gasification projects. As you're aware, Eskom is in the process of doing this, and they have a pilot up and running at the Majuba power station, highly effective because it was actually connected to the generators to their turbines in November last year. By 2012, ensure that the industrial policy action plan has been fully explored, how local and global climate change responses may be fully exploited by the platinum, uranium and copper mining industries. Obviously, this is looking at the exploitation of climate change from an industrial point of view. Platinum, of course, for the use in vehicle catalysts to reduce pollution, uranium, of course, for the nuclear power station, sector, and copper for the energy efficiency point. And work with the mining industry to increase energy efficiency across its production processes.
Isn't it Durban, Itakwini, that has put something on their rubbish dumps,
yes,
and it's methane they collect and then they use?
Absolutely.
This is the problem, you see. I wish we had more time with this green paper. You see, when you look at this, if each department gives you their, and we put it in the paper, you know, we lose out on so much. Because exactly like this capturing of the methane should be a kind of a thing that runs across whatever it can run across. So, you know, you should be able to have a place where we, for example, very much bring about and encourage the kind of thing that Itakwini is doing in all the big metropolitans and big towns. So, you know, you kind of, when you put it in compartments like this, we're going to lose out a lot of things. Any guess? What
is it? There's so much I could tell mine about
So the green paper will do that, but you know, the big problem, of course, is that we're not engaging. I don't think Business South Africa is coming, but you see, all these industries are not coming, and they're not coming.
The Chamber of Mines should be.
But they're not coming there, so you're not going to engage them on any of these things. So the only way we can do this is through government. And government departments are not coming either, so makes it a bit difficult. But I think the point I want to make is not a negative one. It's just that when one deals with, say, something like methane and where are the possibilities of actually harvesting it and capturing it, those things I think we're going to miss out because, you know, like mineral and energy or mineral and mining will say that they're going to do that in the mines, but you lose it out elsewhere. But maybe it's something you just can take into consideration. Then.
Just one comment I want to make, not a question. I mean, the I think it's International Mining Council. I've done so much, you know, for their interest. I've done so much work on mining and climate change that I suspect the kind of things that people can add to the debate on how the mining sector needs to respond to climate change are really quite substantial in a rather general way. But I mean, the mining sector have acknowledged this as a major threat to their, because it's extractive, highly carbon intensive, and then of course you have to transport it all around the world, and if not, then you have to process it in your country, which is another. So I mean, the sector, from a kind of broad international response, knows exactly the challenge and the threat. Our job generally as legislators is to make sure that in the appropriate forum, whether it's YARO and the mining committee, make sure that the department certainly has taken account of the full value chain of carbon when it comes to this particular sector.
Okay, next.
Next sector is tourism.
Just hang on, Dr. Wang.
Chairperson, I think it's regarding the mining. Yesterday, the Minister of Finance announced, I don't know if it's the Department of the Environment is here for the AMD budget. How much they allocated to the AMD regarding the mining environment, this issue? Because it is AMD is very important for the mining water, then it's refund this money where in future is from the department side. How can get this refund come to the department side or the go to the industry side? So I think the cabinet already approved for this funding, but yesterday also announced, you know, by the minister. So I like from the your department side can clear more. How you deal with this issue for the reclaim fund from this profit making? think.
Are we saying anything in this paper on the kind of mining practices that degradate the environment? I mean, AMD, for example. And shouldn't we? I mean, isn't that something we want to make policies about?
Not a climate change policy.
I suppose more environmental generally. If the water keeps on raining the way it does, then these things... But okay.
So there was certainly in the early discussion that we had with mining and minerals, when we looked at the kind of the things that we were expecting from them, one of the things was around open cast mining, for the simple reasons that it removes large amounts of absorptive capacity for actually absorbing carbon. So basically what you can do is you can take forests and you just put a huge drag line and you just destroy everything. And in its place you actually then open up a coal field that then releases methane. So you basically destroy carbon assimilation capacity and replace it with massive carbon releases. And so there was some kind of like quite complex sort of discussions around how we do that, and that of course ended up right straight slap back in the whole sort of environmental impact management mining situation. And so it hasn't really come into the paper at all.
It has. Are we going to, or is anyone, you made a comment early on which I was interested in. You said we've got 200 years with coal left and we're going to mine it, which you said rather forthrightly. I mean, my personal feeling is that just because we have 200 years of coal left doesn't mean we should mine it. And I guess the coal has to supply the existing coal power stations through their cycle, I mean the cycle of peak, plateau and decline. But we also have a choice, we also have other choices, like do we want to mine coal for export for burning in India and for burning in China? And so what I'm interested in is, bearing in mind that the argument, well, who's responsible for the carbon footprint? I mean, if the coal comes out here, granted there's a footprint in mining it and then transporting it, and then the burner finally, we're probably responsible for those emissions. But I mean, is government actually interested in looking at, against the LCMS, how much actually of certain minerals we should allow to be exploited? You know what I mean? Because, I mean, I'm just working on my view, that just because I've used it before, I mean, to keep the coal in the hole. Mm. Just because you have it doesn't mean you have to use it. And has anyone actually modelled, or is anyone vaguely interested in modelling, actually, up to a point in the future, maybe we shouldn't give any more coal mining licences at all? Bearing in mind as well, depending on the extent of the mine, I mean, you can have an open cast coal mine in Mpumalanga that lasts for 18 months, which is quite common. Little pockmarked pimple mines have come up, or you could have Exxaro next to Madupi, which is going to operate for decades. It's a thought that came into my head now, something I've particularly thought about. But I just don't like the idea that just because we have something, we have to exploit it.
I suppose, really, you know, one thinks about it, and I agree we have to be pragmatic about these things, is that in the end of the day, a country trying to struggle to go on a developmental path that needs to create jobs. I mean, a lot of the cautions and the things you've raised around why aren't we moving fast enough on renewables is clearly because there is a source readily available as to deal with, on the one hand. So it's very difficult to get politicians and to get industry to start saying, well, you know, we'll go there, despite all these statistics we have on climate change and so on. Because, I mean, I was just thinking as you were talking, even if we were to rapidly go to renewables and a bigger percentage of our energy comes from there, we have to use less coal. That is us. But the fact of the matter is that will not necessarily happen in other countries. They would then want the coal. and we'll sell it to them. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is whether we pump the coal into the air or whether China or India or someone else pumps it there, it goes into the air and we're all going to get buggered up by it. So I think that, you know, that's the reality of it, and I suppose until one is a more developed country and until there are other sources of energy available and one can start having different debates, it seems highly unlikely in the short term that, and even the medium term, that the debate is seriously going to vie away from to do the study.
There's only one other caveat, of which is probably a better argument in favor of what I would like, is an ability to say at some point we shouldn't be mining. And that is the argument which says, well, you focus rather on the area where you mine and less on what's under the ground. And to be able to say, just because we have coal doesn't mean we have to mine it. Because in X areas, you could argue that the effect of extraction in that area, or the cumulative effect of extraction in that area, would have a overwhelmingly negative impact on the water resource, where you can more explicitly look at the benefits.
And that's a more winnable argument.
I'll reframe it. I mean, the carbon argument, I think the chairperson has made a good point, because, and I had has something I've considered before. I mean, we can stop it, but the mining sector is going to say, well, we're going to export it to India anyway, which presumably their peak plateau demand thing is probably off the charts, quite frankly, compared to ours. Because in the arguments of what the allowable carbon space is, when you times by the number of people, I mean, I'd imagine they are far off what they even want to peak at. So I take the chair's point. I mean, I saw obviously you would like us to be advocates. I understand the pragmatism. I think the best argument, though, is to say we need to delineate certain areas in South Africa and say, for solid reasons of water and loss of potential soils, because I think that's the other choice you make when you extract, is you lose not just the ability to absorb carbon, but the ability to produce food. Anyway, it's a debate which is going to go on for the next 30 years.
Well, what it does do, and I think you must note this down, is that I think what it does do is for us to look at, when we finish with our public hearings, whether we want to suggest that there is something put in the green paper about practices we may all agree is going to have a huge detrimental effect on the environment, and which will either be a cause or a exacerbation of climate change. You know, I mean, this open coal mining you're saying, or open mining, and that, you know, it may very well be that we want to start a process where we start that debate, that certain kind of mining and in certain areas we want to, as a nation, say, just like we've created parks for animals and for fauna and flora, because we're looking at the future, you may very well want to do that. So I think you must put that as one of the issues that I think we may, even if we don't want to make specific suggestions, but very much that it must be an area that is part of the policy paper. Mr. Greiler?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the sister comes down to is the need for full cost accounting, which I don't think we're probably doing in South Africa at this stage. So we need to look at the externalities of, for instance, mining, as well as energy production from certain sources. Now, the Department of Energy was supposed to have done a study into the externalities of energy and different sources from that. But they haven't done that study yet. And when I keep questioning, they tell me how difficult it is. But I really think that will then give us a quantifiable way of saying, this is what it's costing us to follow certain routes, and so therefore we can estimate what the cost to our total society is, and therefore we can start to actually put ourselves on a different trajectory. But I don't know if that should be the responsibility of the Department of Energy, or if that should be the responsibility of the Department of Environmental Affairs to do such a study. But I'd just be interested to hear what your comments are on that.
Thank you very much. These are all important points. The 200 years of coal story, I mean, I agree. You don't take the coal out because it's there. You take it out because somebody wants it. And I think this comes straight back to the whole importance of an international agreement on climate change. Unless we actually have a working international agreement, we don't have an international, we don't have a working solution. Because if we say, if we assume that we're not going to have a proper working international agreement, then we may as well just can this green paper, because it's really not going to make any difference. Which is a horrible thing to say, but the reality is that this is the honest truth. If, for instance, South Africa becomes climate change saints overnight, but nobody else does, we suffer the complete consequences and just cannot afford those consequences. And that really comes down to the whole sort of situation. I would imagine that there is no, in 200 years' time, there'll be no one who wants to buy coal. That in 200 years' time, that coal will probably be regarded as being one of the most important weapons of mass destruction ever seen. And so no one will be touching it. So that's really what it boils down to.
If they can find it, eh?
They found it already, I'm afraid. And they found it.
They couldn't find it in Iraq.
Oh, they did. It was called oil.
That was a weapon of mass greed, not mass destruction.
But within that, that's, I think, is an important aspect of the whole, of the aspects around mining. And one of the things that has come through quite strongly, and you'll see that one of the actions that we have to do is we have to look at the sectors that may be affected from a jobs perspective. And that, of course, has come from most of the ministers who said, what are the job implications of the policy? And so we have to, in terms of policy, we have to actually also look at the effects that will be affected by this kind of stuff. The reality is that we've seen this in the past, is that 60 years ago, when we extracted gold in the eastern part of the country, we would also extract arsenic with that as well. Yeah. It was an arsenopyrite. And of course, we'd used to pull out the arsenic and then use the arsenic as a base for pesticides. And so we realized it was just poisoning everybody. And then no one in the world uses arsenic anymore. And so now we no longer actually extract the arsenic from the ore, simply because no one wants to buy it. The unfortunate thing now is that arsenic goes into the landfill, but that's another issue altogether. In terms of the question around the externality study, as far as I understand, the externality study has been done. And I believe we've done it. But I'm not sure if it's a public document. I think it could have been an internal strategic document about our input into the IRP. So I think, and it was, so therefore, I mean, I'm not quite sure about its scientific integrity or whatever, whether it was just a neat sort of a sketchy study or what have you, but it was just to try and get a feel.
Yeah.
As far as I understand, it's there.
Can we get hold of it, or is it?
Well, I've seen an early draft, so I think you're right to the DG.
I think
we do. Moving on to tourism. This is often seen as an area of, well, you know, what does tourism have to do with climate change? But of course, if one considers that most of our tourism, no matter how much we'd love to think that international people are coming to visit us, they're actually coming here to visit our animals and our beauty and the beauty of our country. And if, for instance, that is undermined, of course, there's a dramatic implication for our tourism industry as well. So the whole aspect of mainstreaming climate change in tourism planning, policy and development, building up climate resilience in terms of capacity around tourism attractions and encourage green tourism, there is a real chance for niche marketing here in terms of ecotourism. One of the biggest threats to tourism as well is potentially the impact of travel miles, where people will say South Africa is a long-haul destination and therefore we'd rather travel somewhere else than to South Africa, and which could have major implications. So there's a real requirement for us to start looking at potential of offsetting of travel miles, so that when people come to South Africa, they can pay an additional stuff, what have you, and basically pay for their guilt. But there's work that has to be done there. Energy efficiency programs, and this is the last point, establish programs that allow tourists to offset the emissions generated through their travel to and in South Africa. So in other words, we have to provide our tourism with an opportunity to be responsible tourists, but still encourage them to be here.
When they get here, you only allow them to walk.
The last question that's left about tourism on property development, what role does the department play to ensure the protection of the and then protection and conservation of the environment.
Well, that of course is our core job, and we do it through environmental impact assessment. We do it through environmental impact assessment. I mean, that's our core job, like our full focus of what we do. So whenever they build new hotels or anything like that, we do proper environmental impact assessment.
And also all the other laws and regulations. I think where the problem lies is with compliance. We have to really jack up our compliance. And they have this environmental compliance campaign now where they are actually starting to build that capacity. So it's one of the focuses we've said as the committee, it's one of the four focuses of us in the area of environment and water action. That compliance and how we increase that capacity and make that capacity better and give them teeth is one of the focuses we should have in the committee. I think the point you raised is very valid.
Also, maybe just to add the concern about the traditional healers, the medicinal plants, what role do they play? Because they have their association, but unfortunately it's not the people who are, you know, scientific in thinking, but they know the plant. Are they also involved?
I don't know.
No, we are. The whole aspect around traditional healers and collection of plants, and it's actually a major focus area of South African National Biodiversity Institute, who do training and do look at conservation and nurseries as well. Because, as you are probably aware, one of the most important destructive mechanisms is more and more people collecting a very, very limited resource, and basically the local extinction of healing plants. And of course, climate change has a dramatic implications for this. I mean, if those plants just cease to be, then that's the end of an entire basis of healing and culture. So, of course, it's of deep concern, and South African National Biodiversity Institute specifically looks at those at plants of economic value.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
The next one is a complex sector. It's transport, and it's an area where there's potentially large opportunities in terms of our development. The first point is that we have to start looking at transport policies and developments that result in what we call this modal shift in passenger transport. And this is basically the shift from moving people out of private vehicles onto public transport, onto mass transport. And you can imagine, for instance, that instead of one person traveling in one car, if you have 20 people sitting in a bus, the reduction is the emission divided by 20. So
is that true?
Absolutely.
I mean, I sit and I look at those buses sometime and I see they've got more people in the car, but I also see plumes of black smoke, and I'm just thinking to myself, I don't know if this is like the greatest thing to ever happen, because, you know, it obviously burns my... I mean, look, taxis. I can understand taxis because they're a bit smaller, but they still have 15, and... they burn. In any case, it's a stupid point. Let's go.
No, but the thing is, it's correct. I mean, if we can actually move from that into bigger mass transport, like for instance using trains and what have you, there's a far bigger advantage. Even within a coal-fired grid, trains would be the right way to go. The integration of land use and transportation planning, and this is something that's been something that the presidency is looking at very, very carefully in terms of looking at land development, where we put people. We put them, you know, the poorest people who need jobs, the furthest away from the point where they work, and therefore we have to use half of their disposable income just purely to get there. And it's found that, for instance, some people find themselves feel richer living in informal settlements and shacks close to their workplace than they do. And this is a huge difficulty and a problem. It's nice to see, for instance, that a city of the size of Cape Town is starting to actually start putting cycle lanes in the middle of town. I've never seen that in a South African city, and that's a real step forward, I think.
It's a legacy of apartheid, but all the new towns and cities do the same. If you drive through South Africa, and you drive through a little town, you'll see where they build all the low-cost housing, they still build it the furthest away from the center of town. I mean, in every single town it's like that. So, you know, it has become... because it's entrenched in the legacy we have, we've just gone, just went along and still do the same damn thing. I mean, yeah, District 6 was supposed to be, of course, there were poor people living here and so on. They were supposed to rebuild this. Now it just stands empty because it hasn't been done. But in any case, again, it's me just.
But within that as well, I mean, but the points are really, really important. And the thing is about the climate change policy is that there's a real chance to do some really good stuff. Now, if one looks at this, and it came through very, very strongly once again in the budget vote around our major investment in the vehicle manufacture sector and how it's such a major provider of jobs. But, you know, we produce huge amounts of Mercedes-Benzes, but perhaps not very many bicycles. And if one looks at the actual, what people can afford in terms of transportation, we have a culture of cycling. So there's a whole bunch of areas that we can start looking at in terms of just the way that this behavioral change stuff. This is an area that's come under quite a lot of criticisms from specifically from industry, because they sort of said, you know, that's, you provide us again with motherhoods of we need to move, we have to have this rail-to-rail move to freight space. We have to get freight off the roads and onto the railway lines. And they said they're 100% supportive of that. But until such time as we have a decent rail network and a rail system, what have you, there's no way that they'll be doing that. So, and industry is sort of criticized, and you can put it in as many policies as you like, but unless we start seeing something really changing within the rail freight situation, it's just not going to happen. But it's there again. We need to move this from freight off our roads and onto our rails. Improve the efficiency of the vehicle fleet. That has already been looked at from an economic instruments point of view, as you've seen again. We had the tax on the carbon emissions tax on vehicles. And interesting enough, in yesterday's situation, there's an increased tax on vehicles over 900,000, which in many instances, vehicles of that size are normally very, very large vehicles, designed like bricks, and have to have things like V8 engines inside them just to move them. So there's economic instruments that are already looking at the situation. The deployment of cleaner technologies for the transport sector, such as electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, and building the capacity to deal with transport mitigation in the areas of planning, engineering, and relevant technical skills. Cleaner fuels. There's implement the flat rate specific exercise tax based on passenger vehicle carbon emissions. We've already looked at that. Consider incentives in the form of lower fuel taxes to encourage cleaner fuels. Consider a 3-year accelerated depreciation allowance for plants and equipment for biofuels. That's part of the policy already. Integrate climate change information into transport planning in order to minimize the potential risk to infrastructure from extreme weather events. This is an area that is normally disregarded, but of course with increased floods and what have you, our transport infrastructure is highly at risk. Our railway bridges, our road bridges, and so forth. And we've certainly seen it in the recent floods as well with bridge washaways and so forth.
Thank you, Chairperson. For regarding the transport, maybe this question is also like the Chairperson says, stupid. But I think now these 2 days are highlighted in the Kaohsiung, this tolling system. I don't know, this tolling system so can involve to the mitigation for the CO2. Also, I think it's for the public hearing regarding for after next week. The department also attend for the public hearing. I want to know. Because I see this yesterday we received from the secretary give us all the comment from the everywhere. Inside is last night reading some this detail regarding what today is a presentation. I think quite important can link together. If the department not attend for the public hearing, I don't think there is can success for this public hearing. This is number one I like to know. Then number two, for the next week, this workshop, a regional workshop from the UK, some attended to us. I think Chairperson, you holding for the this workshop. Department also attended for this workshop. This one I want to know, because this is a 2-day workshop. It's very important from the department side also. Must be participated. Yeah. So for this transport issue, yeah, like the my colleague Morgan said, this in future all the the vehicle will change to the replace to the this electrical vehicle. This government will keep the policy for the subsidy for the you replace the new system by the you driving for the this electrical vehicle. So I just say from the this green paper side, this policy side, I don't know if the public hearing can assist us and this committee and the department how much. Because quite big this detail inside. I'm very interested and excited for how we can deal with this from department side. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, sir, I mean, the department's involvement in your public hearings, as I understand, are taking place 3 days a week over the next couple of weeks. The climate change section of the department consists of 3 people at this stage.
Mm.
And we have a COP 17 to organize. So it really stretches the capacity of the department to actually sit through every single public hearing. But Chair, of course, that remains with you.
You'll have to be here every day.
It'll
have to be here every day. I mean, how will you know what the issues are that people are raising and the issues that we're raising if you're not here?
Well, I'd hope the department would keep records of the hearings.
No, you must be here. Absolutely. Well, they don't necessarily have to answer questions, but they have to be here. No, you're going to have to. I mean, this is not negotiable. I don't expect you to come to the conference, because Dr. Wong mentioned that, but I mean, that's a WEPA conference and so on, so that's fine. But no, I mean, the public hearings, I want you to take the public hearings seriously. You're not taking it seriously if you don't want to be here.
I'd love to be here.
No, then you make space for it, because I mean, there's the public hearings are the South African people's attempt to come to Parliament to say their say on climate change. And if you want to reflect their views and so on in the paper, then don't rely on the MPs alone to do a report. We'll do a report, but in the end of the day, it's very vital that you hear these inputs and that you're part of the process. I don't know what part of that wasn't made clear to the department. I mean, I've always been very strong on this. But let's leave it at that. I'm sure you'll arrange your things accordingly.
Sure.
We've now made it shorter, of course, in terms of taking away Fridays and so on, so at least less days. Are we sitting longer on days? So that there's less other days. All right. And the transport issues that were raised? Let's look at. Respond to any of the other issues Mr. Huang raised?
Sure, I'm not sure I got them, I'm afraid. The only ones I did get was our involvement.
Okay. All right, go to the next one.
Disaster management. Well, this has continued to develop and improve our early warning systems, and as I pointed out in the first days, we've actually got a couple of good warning systems up and running. We're looking at some very innovative approaches, but as you also correctly pointed out, is that there's still a massive need to get clearer warnings onto the ground. This is an increased uptake of seasonal climate forecasts. This, of course, is really, really important for the water and the agricultural sector. This maintain and update the South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas is exceptionally important. And it's not just around disaster management, but it's around things like, for instance, reflecting these indicators that we talked about in terms of malaria and what have you, to start looking at the vulnerabilities of where there could be increases of pests in certain areas and disease movements. And then there's investigate and implement plans to use the mass media and information and communication technologies, including the use of radio, TV, SMS, cellular phone, text, warning message, to alert threatened populations timelessly, and of course their representatives. Promote research and development around the products that might facilitate increased uptake of seasonal climate forecasts among stakeholders. And of course, using the existing social and community organizations and networks, farmers, organizations, NGOs, and so on and so forth, to keep people completely informed of potential risks and disasters. And strengthen both formal and informal education in respect of climate change, disaster risk reduction, and climate change adaptation. On the last point, for example, the concern in November around lightning strikes that killed individuals. It was actually a school outing where 7 individuals were killed. Although lightning has, we have a very, very high level of lightning strikes in South Africa. We account for 10% of the global strikes. And we have around 150 people dying a year of lightning strikes. So we're very, very high. It's just 5 times more than the US, in fact, which is quite, 3 times higher than the US. That takes into account landmass as well. There is a requirement purely around education, around how you deal with these kind of extreme weather events. And we know that, for instance, thunderstorms are part of South African life, and with them we have lightning. So the whole aspect around education, both formal and informal education, around building up a resilience to extreme weather events is exceptionally important.
Right, any issues there? Sounds straightforward. Yes. Dr. Wang?
I think it's you just highlighted for you have the good warning system. I don't know what is good warning system for your department that distributes to the all the country, each province, or like the disaster center or not. I think this question is 2 days ago I also asking, but not answer for the property. Later, I'm not unhappy. So can you quite clear say what is the good warning system by your department in the whole country? Thank you.
I think the most important thing that has to be reflected here is much more efficient mechanisms and techniques of communication. You know, and all the things we raised yesterday about communication, I think it should be part of this. You know, it's no use that you're talking internally to yourselves. You may have a good system talking to yourselves, warning each other, warning countries. The problem is that whole communication things vis-a-vis government and its citizens has to be strongly sharpened, and I would definitely suggest that Ms. Bulatia that very strongly emphasizes that and makes sure that it happens. But we had that whole discussion
yes.
yesterday. You heard it.
Yes.
You?
Yes.
Any responses to Dr. Wang?
Yes. First of all, we have the National Disaster Management Act, which is a piece of legislation that came into effect in 2003 that has established the National Disaster Management Center and the provincial disaster management centers and disaster management centers in all cities as well. Those have been up and running for some time. And the National Disaster Management Center is probably one of the most high-tech national disaster centers in the world, in fact. As I said, it was built up on the Y2K situation. It has satellite imaging. It has full databases of every single school, river, hospital, what have you. It has systems that do early warning on flood relief and flash floods with information provided by the South African Weather Service, Department of Water Affairs, Department of Agriculture. It has fire warnings. That is, and for instance, when you see the TV and it says high chance of fire and what have you, all that information is being fed out. In all these sort of situations, it has direct links to the ground, so if there's a potential for a flash flood, for instance, the local municipality and all the response authorities are informed of that, so they can start putting into things evacuations on the ground, flood protection, and so on and so forth. As I said, no, it's been a highly effective one in terms of the way South Africa responds to extreme weather events, we're normally in a situation where our response allows our emergency services to be freed up to actually assist other countries as well. And for example, the work that we did around the Mozambican floods in 2000 was a direct result of our early warning systems allowing South Africa to respond effectively and freeing up some resources to help our neighbors who just don't have the resources to do that. That doesn't mean that we're 100%. We're far away from that. But the system has been improving dramatically over time. It falls within the Department of Traditional Affairs, and it sits there. The National Disaster Management Center is really worth the visit, actually, because it's like going to NASA. It's a very, very impressive center. I have no idea. This is the Department of this is not our department at all. The disaster management doesn't fall under our department.
All right, next one.
Terrestrial biodiversity. Chair, this is an exceptionally difficult area for the simple reason that, you know, you may have, for instance, Dr. Mitchell talking about how various plants are moving southwards. It often conjures up in your mind the idea that there's trees, like, you know, marching towards the sea. Of course, that doesn't happen. There's natural movement, and that natural movement has been, of course, has...
So Avatar is not true.
No, I'm afraid not. Well, not in this country. But there are natural barriers, and for instance, with the natural barriers often are mountains and high levels and what have you. We also have our own built barriers like roads and what have you that actually stop natural migration. There's huge internal debate about what do we do about this, and there's things like, for instance, we just sacrifice certain species. We have to have gene banks in place so that we don't have this. Well, we have mass extinctions, but at least we keep the genetic material to have to reintroduce. There's a whole aspect of trying to move species from one area to another. The whole aspect of trying to open up natural levels of movement to reduce other barriers. But as you can see, I mean, it's really a very, very difficult situation. I mean, this is nature. How do you actually start managing every single aspect of nature? And it becomes exceptionally difficult. So within that, there's a whole thing about monitoring efforts and experimental studies around what we can do. Building a partnership to enable effective management of areas under formal protection. Looking at trying to increase the conservation estate to build up resilience of particular ecosystems. So this protected area planning, expansion strategies. Looking at biodiversity monitoring systems, and to a large extent, I mean, we found internationally that biodiversity monitoring systems are a very, very good indicator of climate change. And as Dr. Mitchell pointed out, for instance, we know of various species that have gone extinct as a direct result of changes in their entire habitat, and habitats that they've been exploiting for thousands, if not millions of years. Is now no longer there, and they just died out. Combating the spread of alien species, also an exceptionally difficult task. If, for instance, the actual weather system changes completely and makes it more, makes it far more viable for exotics than it is for indigenous plants. Promote efforts to conserve, rehabilitate, and restore natural systems. This is probably one of the most proactive things we can do around biodiversity. Is in terms of storm surges, for example, some of the most dramatic storm surges we've seen in Southeast Asia, for example, have been exacerbated by the fact that there's been massive deforestation of mangrove forests. Mangrove forests are a natural protection on coastal lines, and as they've been cut down, the energy of the waves is not reduced by the trees anymore, and so therefore the waves actually go further inland and cause far more destruction. South Africa, we're exactly the same. We've also destroyed massive amounts of mangrove forests up in KwaZulu-Natal, which has basically reduced the capacity of these natural systems to reduce the impact of storm surge. The same thing goes with the destruction of wetlands. Wetlands are natural ways of reducing flood damage. So in terms of terrestrial biodiversity, there's a real need to take the natural systems that provide us with resilience to climate change, and to conserve them, and where possible to actually rehabilitate and rebuild them.
Anything there? to the botanist. Okay, next one.
In terms of marine,
I never thought I'll actually get this committee never to ask a question on a particular topic. Let's pass quickly.
It's getting late. In terms of marine biodiversity, this is an area that we really don't know enough about, and so therefore a lot of the intentions here is to actually learn more about it, more research and what have you. But the reality is that, I mean, the oceans warm, and they are warming, and the ocean acidification is a real cause for concern. I mean, if, for instance, we have ocean acidification, the doctors didn't actually mention the implications of that. The implications of that is that anything that forms a shell will no longer form a shell. It's just because basically the water becomes more acidic and it just can't form the shell. So the impacts of that are dramatic in terms of the marine biodiversity and you know, communities that are reliant on marine resources. Once again, the whole thing about using your natural systems for building resilience, mangrove swamps, reefs, and our coastal dunes.
Anything there? Bumbling.
Then, in terms of commercial forestry, research has shown that although we may not have a reduction in commercial forestry, there's a real chance that commercial forestry will have to change from one area to another area. So, in other words, an area that is now perfect for forestry may not be perfect in the future, and they would have to move those forests. Which, of course, also means that, for instance, the infrastructure of sawmills and whatever would have to move as well. But there's also an aspect of looking at commercial forestry as carbon sinks and looking at sustainable forests too, is to continuously increase our carbon sinks. There is a whole aspect of encouraging agroforestry as well and indigenous tree production. Now, this is a very interesting one. I mean, whenever we think of forestry, we'll always think of exotics. We don't have a sort of situation, you don't have South African thorn forests, for example. We don't grow our own hardwoods. We've got some of the most beautiful hardwoods in the world. We'd rather grow oak than our own hardwoods. And when it comes to forestry, we grow pines and eucalyptus and so on and so forth. So we create these green deserts, really. So the whole chance of looking at reforestation, the one comment that people often put is saying, from a job creation point of view, is getting trees back and getting cedars back in the Cedarburg. As you're aware, I mean, we have a Cedarburg. We've got a single cedar in the Cedarburg. And they were, because they were locked 150 years ago, for mines and for railway sleepers. But there is a whole aspect, for instance, that in that particular area we have massive unemployment, but there could be a real chance of actually doing reforestation work, unskilled work. It's basically agricultural work, but it would have to be government supported because there's no commercial value to it. So it's basically the restoration of forest.
Anything on that? Other than asking the department if they have it on their budget for such a project, so we can start reforesting the Cedarburg. Please get a budget.
Chair, you know, to be honest, I mean, we've talked about this, but there's never been a sort of situation of costing such a program. And perhaps it is worth our while to cost this program to see how it would work.
I mean, you've got the whole public works program. I don't know, I listen, there's a huge amount of money given to public works. This is a perfect public works project. So, as you say, I mean, if the department costs this, then it's a question of just going to public works and say, these are the amount of people we can employ, plus we're going to create a whole new area that will be able to gobble up carbon. And this is what it's going to cost. And you know, it's those kind of things that I think, look, you know, public works are great.
And I think, you know, those kind of things would actually turn the paper into something where it's not like kissing your sister. There'll be some tangible, exciting stuff that people can get their teeth into.
It's like kissing your girlfriend. That'd be much more exciting. Of course, not forgetting your wife. Yeah, that's right.
And onto fisheries, and the same applies.
That was just a joke, please, guys. My wife hears that. Okay.
Yeah.
in terms of fisheries and what have you, and this, and I think the second bullet point here is an important one. Take a risk-averse approach to fish and marine resources harvesting quotas to ensure that overexploitation is not responsible for local extinctions and population crashes and climate-stressed areas. This is, comes back to, in fact, this committee used to deal with it for many, many years around fisheries quotas and what have you, but what is now is an extra stress on our fisheries resource. once again, this whole aspect of measuring increased monitoring, aspect of poaching, the legal fishing, and so on and so forth. Investigate how the risks and uncertainties of the wild fisheries may be reduced. You can imagine, for instance, with sea level rise, areas that are now current fish hatcheries may be inundated. And may be destroyed. So the whole basis of the fisheries ecosystem could be destroyed through sea level rise and through storm surge. And so we have to keep a very, very wary eye on this. And, this, and fish
so
do
the
move.
Sea gets too hot, it's cold, or whatever.
And they move.
Too dirty, too acidic.
Then within that sort of situation, I mean, in terms of looking at uncertainty and building up resilience to it as well, the whole aspect of, for instance, looking at fish farming and upscaling fish farming is an important aspect of that as well.
Anyone?
Infrastructure in the built environment, urban areas. This goes into quite a lot of detail, but it really is around town planning. To be honest, if one looks at the way that we cut out cut the cake around our greenhouse gas emissions is normally around industrial sectors and where they are. But if one looks at it geographically, our emissions are all coming, the majority of them are from our big cities. The electricity we generate, the transport and what have you, this is where this is coming from. And a whole bunch of work around mitigation is within the cities. The other aspect is that cities are also very, very slow to adapt. We have all this massive infrastructure, some buildings 300 or 400 years old. And to adapt to changing climates and to things like sea level rise and what have you are always quite difficult in terms of cities. The whole aspect of looking at water-sensitive urban design, the working for water programs and so on, are really, really important. But it really boils down to the whole sort of situation, and the way somebody has described it in the provincial workshops was that we need to retrain our town planners. Our town planners have to go back to school, because this is a completely different ballgame. And the whole old-fashioned, post-modern approach to town planning of keeping people houses away from the places that they work is now really just an old-fashioned idea that has to be.
That's the wonderful thing if you go to Paris, you know. I mean, I just love it, because what you find is you get all the houses, and then underneath you get all the restaurants and so on. This whole American concept that you live there and you work and that there is just an alien thing.
Mm-hmm.
You go to a city like Paris and you can live in and do all your shopping and everything you can do in a little area, because everything is in that area. And that is just a completely different way of town planning than you could ever. This other thing that we've got, this thing that came in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s. We create these soulless. So I agree. Retrain them. Send them to training camps. All town planners, training camps. Put it in the paper. Take them to Paris. They'll definitely stop kissing their sisters if they go to Paris.
So with that as well, it talks about the downscaling of models, but we've also heard how difficult that is to try and downscale models. But within that sort of situation, we must be able to provide cities with some indication of the kind of stuff that they have to take into account when they plan. Energy efficiency, of course, once again, it comes straight down to the buildings and improving the energy efficiency of our buildings. The whole thing about evaluating a city's ongoing resilience, there are only two major cities that have done this in any major detail, and that's Cape Town and Etiquini, Durban. And they've done some excellent work to see how they would respond to sea level rise and how they need to build resilience in the city. And it's good work, but and hopefully it's influencing their planning as well, but it has to. Regulate commercial building standards. This is already underway. It falls under, of course, the SABS, and which basically the South African building standards are actually set by the Department of Trade and Industry. and that whole process is being reviewed, and they're looking at this. The whole aspect around green building is an important one. But within this sort of situation, one of the things that has been brought up in the provincial workshops is that we're certainly looking at a lot around new buildings, in terms of looking at new building codes or what have you, whereas our real problem lies with the older ones, and where is the stuff around retrofits, and where do we look at that, and so therefore there's probably a need to look at that as well. So that's cities and urban areas. Then in rural areas, rural areas, once again, I mean, are probably the most, have least resilience to major events like this as well, certainly because they just don't have the infrastructure that would protect them. So the whole aspects, for instance, of actually increasing the resilience through water harvesting and these sort of things are really important. All this stuff came from the Department of Rural Development. Once again, the programs that are already in place, working for water, working for wetlands, working on fire, and the new one working on energy, really important for them to be rolled out as well to provide local resilience and livelihoods. Macroeconomic diversification is seen as an important response in rural areas. So a lot of sense, I mean, the stuff around rural areas is it can be seen as very, very much the case of what we need to do anyway in terms of building up rural resilience and the livelihoods of the poor in rural areas. And then coastal areas, of course, risk-averse approach. They have to start planning around sea level rise, storm surges, protection around our protective systems, mangroves, swamps, reeds, and coastal dunes, and the development of disaster risk management plans, taking into account the potential consequences of climate change along the coast, of course, all the ones specific to the coast, being storm surge and sea level rise. I think that's the end of the human settlements and infrastructure and loss and violence.
Yeah, just a quick one. Just on the retrofitting of old buildings, I mean, one of the problems that I seem to have encountered speaking to a property developer is this problem about those that rent apartments or rent office space. It's in their interest to have energy-efficient technologies like solar water because it reduces their energy bill. But it's not in their interest to pay for that because that's a capital cost which the ownership basically pays, but the owner doesn't get the benefit. I don't know if there's been any thought about how you get around that very practical problem, but it really is holding back a lot of these types of things.
That was exactly the point that was brought up in the provincial workshops, and it's an exceptionally important point, but I don't think it's been addressed at all.
Nick?
Yes, it does also mean that we must agree that some of the good practices you anticipate will never ever see the light of day. You know, like encouraging, that is whatever I said here, on human settlements. Because we have in other areas, you know, mushrooming of informal settlements overnight, and other areas are just difficult to put any form of infrastructure. And those are areas where disasters are, you know, where people are vulnerable in as far as disasters are concerned. But I don't know how we deal with situations, because municipalities have tried, but sometimes it's just beyond our control.
Yeah, I think we, obviously, I haven't read this paper completely, but I think it is something we need to see if this paper covers it well enough. This whole area, you see, does it in terms of adaptation and mitigation? But, you know, I think there are issues around local government that are vital, that are maybe not being covered here as substantially as it should. And that issue about where people build in the net line, you know, we have to find ways of putting stronger responsibilities on municipalities. You know, soon, I tell you what's going to happen soon. One day, very soon now, one of these municipalities are going to be sued for people that got killed or their houses got destroyed below this water line, that they didn't do anything about it and just left people there. And I think that's what almost you're going to have to need before you know really move on. But you're right. The problem is there's a lot of these things are covered. There's laws for it. Nothing gets done. There's no compliance. That is also why I was saying the compliance unit of the environment needs to be made much stronger. And they have to have one of the people we should be able to blame is that compliance unit. At the very least, I said to them, they were in front of the committee, I said, I want to see that you've given each municipality that have people living below the, within those water lines and so on. And you go and give them an order, a notice to deal with the issue. If you don't do that, and the municipality just leaves until there's a disaster. That compliance unit should be having that capacity. But I, you know, as I say, a lot of these things, we have laws, we have things, but they're not complied with. Okay, Ms. Bengu?
Thank you, Chair. I would like to also to add on the issue of building houses, of building homes, because, for instance, in the rural areas, finally, people are building their homes up the mountain and also next to the rivers. That is why most of the time they are also vulnerable on lightning rather than the people that are on the urban areas, because one of the scientists in KZN also said that the people in rural areas, they are also vulnerable because the lightning is more on inland rather than the areas that are next to the sea, like Devon. That is why most of the people in rural areas are dying because of this striking of lightning. And also, I'd like to know whether the white paper is, because to me, it's gender blind. Because and how will the climate change impact on women given their unique situation, like the one that I have mentioned before? Thanks.
I think that last point is very important. Gender impact of climate change. And how do we deal with it if we have doubt with it? Mr. Luki? Anyone? Sorry, anyone else? That's it.
Jay, I think, I mean, most of it was debate, but in terms of comments, it's also been a comment that has come through from the provincial workshops as well, and specifically from the head of the Gender Commission, asking for more work around the impacts on women specifically. And although the Green Paper actually talks about vulnerable and vulnerable communities and vulnerable people, there is a strong belief, certainly from the Gender Commission, that there must be far more work on women, and we've asked them to provide us with this with information on that as well.
They're also coming to the hearing. They're one of the submissions. They made a submission, so we'll impact on them.
One of the things we did ask, though, Jay, was we asked them quite clearly, though, is that we want something tangible from the Gender Commission. Simply by sort of saying, you know, well, women aren't covered enough in this Green Paper, it was not helpful. So we've asked.
It doesn't help to do something, a token, to say, well, you know, about women. I mean, it has to be tangible how climate change affects women in particular. And you'll find that it probably will be women in rural areas and how it impacts on them.
Absolutely.
And so on. And but you'll need some specifics. You can't. I mean, the policy has to be about specifics. You can't just be acknowledging that gender. You know, that climate change may impact. So I agree. I mean, we'll need something specific on that.
So the next section now is on waste, and this is an area that falls within the jurisdiction of our department. You can see that the level of detail increases quite dramatically. The first one is a very, very interesting one, and I think something that's really looking at kind of a win-win situation. As encourage and support industries that produce significant quantities of gypsum from flue gas desulfurization. And this is specifically Eskom. The new Eskom power stations will have these vast, huge machines that produce massive quantities of gypsum by taking the sulfur out of their emissions. Now, as it stands, Eskom plans to landfill that gypsum, basically turn a product, which is actually the basis of all ceilings, into waste, because they don't believe there's a market for it. And so this point is just to say we must find a market for it. And one of the most important markets for us is to start looking at ceilings and drywalling in low-income homes. As you know, RDP houses do not have ceilings, which means that they're completely thermally inefficient. Just by installing a ceiling makes a huge difference to those homes. And if, for instance, we're producing the raw materials from a pollution control device, to actually utilize that substance in doing retrofits in low-cost homes is a real win-win situation. Not only are we reducing pollution, but we're also actually reducing pollution from the residential areas and so on.
You must do more here. So this is a wonderful thing. I mean, you know, for example, yeah, the thing we mentioned earlier about government procurement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this will be the ideal situation to now create a ceiling for each RDB house by insisting that in the procurement of those houses, that ceilings at least of this type. Now, that's the way to support those industries, is by specifically making sure that it is a. So I like that. That kind of thing. That this is now where you. This is where the kissing becomes interesting.
No, well, absolutely, and I think this is what we'd like to see from other departments as well, where they apply their minds a bit more. So here's the one around your landfill gas. Ensure that the minimum requirements for landfills, which is the basis of our licensing, are revised in the minute to reflect greenhouse gas mitigation considerations by 2012, including, among others, biocover at landfills not suitable for gas extraction. We have a number of landfills, Chair, that are just too shallow to actually generate gas. But they do generate gas, but it's almost impossible to actually extract it. But just by putting biocover on top, which is basically compostable material on top, actually does the same job. Energy recovery from landfill gas and the negotiation of appropriate carbon offset funding, and ensure that all such landfills are required to at least extract and flare this gas by 2020. So at the moment, this gas is going to waste. And not only is it going to waste, it's a massively strong greenhouse gas. So we're saying here that they have to start looking at generating electricity from it. But at least by 2020, the gas cannot be just let go. It has to be at least flared. And we found that where a landfill then is required to flare, so in other words, they have to put the piping in to put this gas to a potential point where they burn it, it then starts making financial sense for them just to, instead of just burning it, to actually attach it to a device that actually generates electricity. So that's the intention here. And then compile and implement a national composting strategy aimed at reducing the amount of organic waste.
Here's that point I made earlier about local. Okay, it's easier. Good.
In line with waste incineration policy, so that energy recovery from appropriate waste streams through active support to municipalities and development of energy recovery projects and the negotiation of appropriate carbon offset funding. This, the anti-incineration lobby, and there is one in South Africa, is not happy with this particular point. But the reality is that the waste is a stream of energy that is now going to landfill. So that is basically the end of the green paper. And then at the time when we put this forward, we predicted that these would be the expected areas of debate. And I mentioned them before, the energy planning process, which has moved on since then, but it's still an area of debate.
You mentioned it.
Yeah. Energy mix, pricing of carbon, sector targets, intervention resourcing, where does the money come from, and intervention prioritization, which ones do we do first? And those comments have been very, very much reiterated in the
presentations.
Yeah, I just heard the last one in the way, so I'm going to keep it. But the incineration issue, I mean, I've seen this technology that's used in Camden and currently Barcelona as well, and I don't know if you've investigated it. I think it's a plasma converter, but essentially there's no emission from there, and it uses the inherent heat in waste and generates electricity. I mean, it seems like a complete win-win, but I've never heard it really talked about in South Africa. Is that being looked at all?
As I said, you know, there's actually a very strong anti-incinerator lobby. That has really kind of stymied any discussion around thermal treatment of waste. Even to the extent as that, for instance, they lobbied against burning medical, or let me call it by the right name, health risk waste, which of course really is the best and most effective way of actually dealing with health risk waste, things like body parts and what have you.
Why are they so strong? Why don't we just tell them to?
Well, the thing is, this is a bit embarrassing. In my previous life, I was the start of the anti-incineration lobby in the late 80s. But unfortunately, at that time, it was actually a very, very...
Each one of you come here. Dr. Midley comes here, you come here, tell us about your horrible past.
But within that situation, I mean, what has happened is that at the time, South African incinerators were completely unregulated, and we had the nastiest pollutants coming out of them. Since then, things have changed quite dramatically, and certainly in terms of our control of these devices, I mean, we're in a far better position than we were 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So I agree. I think that the discussion must go forward, and I think us putting through our thermal policy has already changed the debate. It's a case of we're no longer debating whether incineration is good or bad. We're now debating what hard must perform, and that has moved on quite dramatically. But in terms of looking at the proper incineration policies, like, for instance, fluidized beds and so on and so forth, we haven't done enough research on this stuff. Yeah. And that's what that point is about, is to start looking at proper research on how we utilize our waste stream correctly. Yeah, of course, we don't want to, I mean, if, for instance, you have tires, and there's a real chance of actually extracting the tire, the substance of the tire, rather than just burning the tire, then of course that's the way you want to go. But the idea of, like, for instance, landfilling tires is just insane.
Okay, Mr. Lukey, I must say that I have found your inputs over the last 2 days and your grasp of these topics very excellent, and it's been very useful.
Thank you, sir.
Lucky to have civil servants like yourself leading us in this area. Now, there is also a document here that gives us a summary of the kind of issues that have arisen during the provincial hearings and so on. We're not going to go through that document. That you can use during the hearings and so on. One thing I do think, though, you must do for us is that, you know, the last three chapters are not here. I mean, you spoke about them in the beginning, but you've not actually put them in a slide form.
Yes.
Like a 6, 7, and 8.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes 6, 7, and 8, particularly the issues of information and system and institutional, are very vital. So I think you should do that. We're not necessarily going to have a presentation on it, but do us a slide presentation like that so we can just have it. Then I must tell you every time you speak on any issue, I just realize that if we do not make in this white paper a separate and chapter on database, on indicators, and all those stuff, then you can just as well not do this white. You can put as many targets in here as you want to. You can give them detail. You can say on the 5th of March 1925, we're going to do. You can put all targets like that. It's not going to help. If we do not put the institutional infrastructure in place to be able to drive these processes, to monitor these processes, to make them better, to make them work. So I really think that, as a provisional comment, I really think you should, you know, one of the strong recommendations I will make to the committee is is to have a whole chapter on those issues, on indicators, on institutional mechanisms, how we're going to monitor and do those things. Other than that, I just have to thank you, and we start with the public hearings Thursday, Friday next week, 2 o'clock Thursday, 9:30, 8:30 Friday. You should have all the submissions. You should have the format of how people are going to come. There may be some changes because clearly we didn't consult with everyone the time slot again. But we've told them that if you want to change the time slot, you find someone to change it with. We won't do that. So I think that gives us a good grounding now to start. If you can make it next Monday to those trips, I won't be able to make it, but those that can. But please, let's try and make as many of us as possible to the conference, because here we're engaging our counterparts in SADC and so on, and I think it'll be very important what happens in those countries. Of course, also impacts on us here. So thanks for all your attendance and your diligence in the week, and I think it's been a good week. Thank you very much, Mr. Lukey. Yes, yes.
69.